Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm really excited today to be speaking with Jeremy Scahill. I've been listening to Jeremy Scahill on the radio myself for at least a couple years here. He was working with Democracy Now!, Amy Goodman and Democracy Now!, and he's from the United States. He lives in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and he works now with Free Speech Radio News. He's an independent journalist, and one of the main things he does is Free Speech Radio News. So he's just visiting here for a real short time here in California, and we're just getting to know each other. And Jeremy tells me that he's never had any formal journalism training. He just jumped into it as an activist. He's 26 years old, and I am very impressed always with your reports. Let me stop talking about you and start talking to you, Jeremy. So welcome.
Thank you, Sue. It's great to be here with you.
You are here actually because last night there was a benefit for Free Speech Radio News, and maybe you'd like to say something real quick about what Free Speech Radio News is, and any of you can hear it on the internet, if not on the radio.
Well, one of the things that happens in any struggle, whether it's a labor struggle or it's a struggle of poor people around the world, or any story of resistance or people in a struggle, always builds with that struggle great moments, great people, and great things. And one of the great things that's come of the Pacifica crisis is the emergence of Free Speech Radio News. Free Speech Radio News was formed a couple of years ago in protest of the anti-democratic crackdown and the censorship and the bannings and the firings and the pressuring out of people within the Pacifica Radio Network, and the move toward trying to make the Pacifica Radio Network into a sort of more corporate-friendly network.
Let me just say, for those of you who don't know what Pacifica is, it is, in a word, the oldest and biggest, as far as I know, listener-sponsored free speech institution in the world, certainly in radio, and a very, very important institution in the United States and highly respected internationally. So, and there's been a lot of troubles without spending too much time on all those troubles.
Right. And this, and, you know, and the Pacifica Radio Network has been around for 50 years. And for those 50 years, it has truly been a voice for the voiceless, and served in the greatest tradition of community media and revolutionary media. And over the last several years, there's been enormous problems at the Pacifica Radio Network with pro-corporate managers, anti-democratic leadership within the network, firings, banning, censorship, etc. So one of the sort of parts of that whole censorship and that crackdown had to do with the national evening news program of the Pacifica Radio Network, which is called the Pacifica Network News. And I was working at both Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman half of my time, and then half of my time with Pacifica Network News. And when the situation came to a head with the censorship and the anti-democracy, I basically made a decision, and I said it publicly at an event in New York in 1999, that I would not work for Pacifica Network News until democracy returned to the network. And shortly after that, I worked with like-minded people who had been working for the Pacifica Network News in forming a strike, in launching a strike against that news. And 70% of the people that had been contributing to it over the last several years launched a strike against it called Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. And we have a number of demands that remain right now, which include the restoration of democracy, the fired and banned to the network, and a dialogue about what sorts of programs would best serve listeners and the community in this country. And so out of that struggle, shortly after it was formed, we developed the idea for a newscast that would be an alternative to what we considered to be the very mainstream pro-corporate reporting and bad reporting that was coming out of the Washington Bureau of Pacifica Radio and was being broadcast around the country in the name of Pacifica Radio. And that's how we launched Free Speech Radio News. And now we have reporters in 140 countries around the world. We have some absolutely amazing voices from the developing world, the third world. We have people like Sputnik Kalambi, who's reported out of Kashmir, Rupert Cook, who's been in the Sudan and Somalia, Raphael Kraft, Under the Gun in the West Bank. I reported out of Yugoslavia during the overthrow of Slobodan Milosevic. You know, we have really grassroots reporters doing grassroots stories, and it's truly what the mission of Pacifica should be about. And so now, you know, we've had some victories recently within the struggle for democracy at our network, at Pacifica Radio, but the struggle is far from over. And one of the things that we're working on right now is getting Free Speech Radio News on all of the Pacifica stations to put it up against what continues to be their anti-democratic news program, Pacifica Network News, and say to the listeners, what do you want to hear? Do you want to hear from reporters in 140 countries reporting on issues that don't appear in the American media, or do you want much of the same old BS that we've been hearing on the Pacifica Network News for several years now?
Mm-hmm. And every single interview I do, I think we're talking about the media at some point, no matter what the subject is, because as you said last night in your very rousing speech, and I'd like you to say some more of those things, that the media is crucial in social change. And you can say it much more eloquently than I.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as you know, any country around the world that you visit that has a people in struggle, people fighting for their rights, fighting for justice, just fighting for their survival. Radio is a central conduit, a pipeline of information and an organizing tool for people in resistance. It's the most revolutionary medium that we have in the world. It's it allows rebels to communicate with one another. It allows populations to be informed. You know, and we look at struggles around the world, and we see the central role that radio is playing in those struggles. But a lot of times we don't put ourselves in that context. You know, pro-democracy movements are things that happen elsewhere in the world. Resistance movements are things that happen elsewhere in the world. And even people who are inclined to support a pro-democracy movement elsewhere in the world or a struggle elsewhere in the world don't necessarily think of those of us that are in struggle in the United States as being part of that same bigger family. And I think that that's one of the things that we need to move toward when we talk about rebuilding the Pacifica Network, or when we talk about independent media in this country today. What is our real role? Is our real role just to provide an alternative to the crap that you see on NBC and CBS or that you hear on NPR? Or is our role to build a movement, to be a not just a lifeline, a pipeline of information for people, but to be a mobilizing tool, to be that fax machine in a very different way, in a very simple way, for a movement for justice in this country. And that's the direction that I think that we should be going in, all of us that are involved with independent media.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we have the internet, so that makes it even more widely distributable, even though most people don't have the internet, but you can take stuff off the internet and put it on pirate radio or any kind of radio that'll play it. And you can actually get Free Speech Radio News at FSRN.org. And Jeremy Scahill, you live in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, so although you're American and you're talking about the United States, actually you're not living in the United States, and you're reporting on Yugoslavia, in Iraq, and many other things. So you're getting a little different view, too. So when you're talking about resistance movements being over there, just like the bad things usually happen over there, not to us, and I guess that's changed a little bit in people's minds since 9/11. Anyway, if you would talk more about your vantage point from there and what you're doing there in Yugoslavia.
Well, I mean, actually, Yugoslavia continues to be an extremely sad story. The country was completely shattered and smashed all throughout the 90s in an extraordinarily violent war. And the United States government and the Pentagon and private paramilitary firms from the United States all played very central roles in destroying that country, in funding the Bosnian Muslims and the Croatian army, in giving support for ethnic cleansing operations throughout Croatia and Bosnia. Many people don't know in this country that everyone's heard of Milosevic, and everyone thinks of Milosevic as the mass murderer and someone who's at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal right now and someone who needs to be held accountable for the genocide in Yugoslavia. But very few Americans have been forced to examine the role that their own government played in not just the destruction of Yugoslavia, but the wanton killing of thousands of civilians. The Clinton administration authorized contracts in the mid-1990s to train and arm both the Bosnian Muslim army as well as the Croatian military. The forces that the U.S. trained ultimately became some of the most brutal forces in that war. And in August of 1995, U.S.-backed forces, Croatian forces, ethnically cleansed a quarter of a million Serbs from the Krajina region of Croatia. And the New York Times called it the single greatest ethnic cleansing of the war. And yet that is not being taken up at the Hague War Crimes Tribunal. President Clinton or any of the generals that went over and trained the Croatian forces that carried out this ethnic cleansing appear on no indictments. It's just Slobodan Milosevic sitting in the dock, accepting taking responsibility for every crime that was committed in the secessionist wars and the destruction wars of Yugoslavia. In the case of Kosovo, the United States, ironically, was on the same – not ironically. The United States was on the same side as Osama bin Laden. The Mujahideen fighters who were in Afghanistan were redirected in the mid-1990s to Bosnia and also to Kosovo. These were not Yugoslavs. They were the same Mujahid that were fighting in Afghanistan, and they were sent to Bosnia to fight on the side of the United States for the U.S. men in Bosnia and more recently in Kosovo. And Osama bin Laden was one of the funders of the Mujahideen going into Bosnia and going into Kosovo and participating in a war to break off more territory from Yugoslavia.
Well, and I know I want to let the audience know that as you speak of these things, you were there. I remember hearing reports, oh, the bombs are dropping and we're walking out of Kosovo. I heard you talk some about that last night. So this is not like some armchair philosophy here.
Yeah. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing to watch a U.S. occupation. And in June of 1999, I saw with my own eyes U.S. forces occupy a significant part of Yugoslavia. They essentially came in and took over Kosovo. And there was extraordinary brutality happening in Kosovo from various sides. Certainly the Serb forces and the Yugoslav army forces there were not exactly passing out flowers to civilians. And you had the Kosovo Liberation Army, backed by the United States, armed by the United States covertly, razing Serbian villages to the ground, attacking any non-Albanian populations or Albanians that did not agree with the Kosovo Liberation Army. So you had many of the vast majority of civilians of Kosovo during this whole conflict were caught between very, very thuggish, criminal, scary forces assembled known as the Kosovo Liberation Army, and then this equally brutal force from Milosevic's inner circle, the special police units, the paramilitary units, the Yugoslav army units in Kosovo. The vast majority of civilians were stuck not only between these two sides, but then they also had 79 days of NATO bombing in which 30,000 rounds of depleted uranium were fired off. Cluster bombs were dropped all throughout Kosovo. So many people that the U.S. claimed to be defending were killed by U.S. bombs. I remember in May of 1999, sort of at the height of the bombing, U.S. warplanes bombed a convoy of Albanian refugees. You know, you remember Clinton saying every American should go and home and find Kosovo on a map because that's who we're defending. And the Albanians, the ethnic Albanians, as they referred to them, quote unquote, became the darlings of the West. They were being compared to the Jews and the Holocaust and these extraordinary victims of genocide. And yet the United States on several occasions bombed refugee convoys. One of which was on May 12, 1999, they killed 87 Albanians. in a NATO bombing. They hit the refugee convoy, no military target within sight. And so, you know, you have this violence that the United States was extremely central to creating, and yet there's no accountability for it. There's no indictment of the United States for bombing Radio Television Serbia in April of 1999 and killing 16 journalists. There's no accountability for the direct hits on civilian homes all throughout Serbia. The bridges, numerous bridges, 34 bridges that NATO bombed, the passenger trains that they directly hit, the cluster bombs that they dropped all throughout Kosovo. There's no accountability for that. Milosevic is responsible for it all, and that is the official U.S. policy. And it continues to be the U.S. policy. Any civilians killed in the course of a U.S. bombing the responsibility doesn't lie on the shoulders of Washington for those deaths. It lies on the shoulder of whatever government happens to be in power within the borders of that country. So whether it's the Taliban in Afghanistan, Saddam Hussein in Iraq, or Slobodan Milosevic in Yugoslavia, the U.S. is washing its hands of attempting to wash its hands of an enormous amount of blood. And one of the things that we were trying to do when I was in Yugoslavia was to paint pictures of the struggle of everyday people to live under the gun of American foreign policy that's pointed at them every single day. And so I did interviews with families whose houses had been hit in quote-unquote collateral damage. I interviewed a 14-year-old girl named Nada Matanovic, and I'll never forget her name, who was fleeing Kosovo on a bus, and her bus got hit by cluster bombs, by U.S. cluster bombs, and she had shrapnel in her spine, and the doctor told us very clearly, this girl will never walk again. And what was you know, Nada Matanovic's crime? Was she committing genocide? Was she raping people? Was she an ethnic cleanser? She's a 14-year-old girl. What was her crime? And these are the stories that do not appear in the U.S. media largely. There were some exceptions. Paul Watson of the Los Angeles Times was a fantastic reporter from Kosovo. Robert Fisk of The Independent in London. But basically, the list is very short of people who are telling those kinds of stories. And that's why, you know, the responsibility is very heavy when you say that you're part of an independent media movement or a community media movement, and it makes you realize when you're reporting from somewhere like Yugoslavia and you see the other side of the barrel of the gun, it makes you want to scream out. And one of the ways that you can funnel that outrage, that scream, is through radio. And it's extremely important.
Getting all teary here. I can't even imagine how you do it. And I mean, it's just a 9/11 brought home to some people in some ways. Mostly it just made people mad. But, you know, it's just people just don't seem to get it because they don't have the information. And when they do, it's put in such a way that it just feels very impersonal. But the idea of having bombs drop on you just, you know, it's just got to be horrendous. And back to the issue. And, of course, when these radio stations get bombed right off, you know, I mean, from way back when I was in Grenada doing documentaries on the United States in Grenada, little teeny-weeny island country of 120,000 people of Grenada, well, one of the first things they did was the radio station. Ever since then, it's been very clear to me, I mean, and you don't have to be, what do you call it, a rocket scientist, to know that every time when the radio station is bombed early on, as it just was in Afghanistan, I think, the TV, that doesn't just happen. And all these things don't just usually, probably some of them are accidents, horrible accidents, and a lot of them are not even that.
Excuse me. Well, you know, the U.S. has always had a policy of targeting journalists and targeting media outlets, especially in countries that it's quote-unquote at war with or in conflict with. We certainly saw that all throughout the dirty wars in Central and Latin America. What has sort of elevated or upped the ante, so to speak, was what happened in Yugoslavia in April of 1999 when the United States publicly stated that Radio Television Serbia was a target because it was a arm of propaganda for Slobodan Milosevic. That was the line. And the U.S. ultimately bombed Radio Television Serbia. They didn't bomb the transmitters to knock it off the air, which is very significant. It's very seldom mentioned. They bombed the actual studio, which only put Radio Television Serbia – in fact, I remember it knocked Radio Television Serbia off the air for about 10 minutes. And yet in Washington, they were declaring that they had bombed Radio Television Serbia off the air. Well, they did for 10 minutes, but that night that it was bombed, I remember seeing it on Radio Television Serbia. The footage of RTS being bombed, Radio Television Serbia being bombed, was being broadcast on Radio Television Serbia. So they killed – and you know, Sue, the 16 people that were killed in that bombing – Not a single one of them was a famous journalist. Not a single one of them was in, you know, in the inner circle of Milosevic's party. You know who was killed in that bombing? Makeup artists, technicians, engineers. You know, they were in the building that night because Larry King from CNN had an interview scheduled at 2:30 in the morning, and it was bombed at 2:06 a.m. And so the people who were in there were third shift people. You know, these aren't the these aren't the sort of thugs of Milosevic's media machinery. You know, I've gotten to know the families of the people that died in that bombing. I mean, largely they were people that were afraid that if they didn't go to work, they were going to lose their jobs, and they were people whose family depended on that very small amount of money, less than $100 a month, that they were making from these jobs. You know, you had older men that were killed. You had young women that were killed in that bombing. Not a single one was a propaganda journalist. They were technical people. And they were there because CNN was going to be interviewing the Minister of Information. That was why they were in the building that night. Mm-hmm. And so the place gets hit at 2:06 and 16 people are killed. And, you know, the Hague War Crimes Tribunal said that wasn't a war crime. We had to pressure the Committee to Protect Journalists to even list the 16 people in their annual report of journalists killed. And now the European Court of Justice has just thrown out a lawsuit that the families filed attempting to sue NATO. They're now taking it to a German court and trying to sue Germany for its participation, even though they were U.S. planes. But basically, the Hague War Crimes Tribunal exonerated the U.S. and said that there were some disturbing things that happened, but that they didn't constitute war crimes. Unfortunately, Human Rights Watch has taken the same position. They refused to say that that was a war crime, the U.S. directly hitting a media outlet, killing 16 innocent civilians who had nothing to do even with the production of any propaganda news. They were there for CNN that night.
So in what went on 10 minutes later, was it a takeover also, or just it went on as usual?
No. I mean, this is the whole story that people sort of missed about the bombing of Radio Television Serbia. It went right back on as normal. All the same people who were the sort of journalists from Milosevic's journalists were back on the air within – in fact, they were then broadcasting from an alternative location within 10 minutes of the place being hit. So what I'm saying is that the reason – even if you buy into that horrid rationale that a media outlet is a legitimate target because it serves some propaganda role – we could say that about a lot of media organizations in the U.S., and I certainly wouldn't advocate bombing of CNN or NBC or MSNBC. But the sort of point that was missed is if they wanted to knock Radio Television Serbia off the air, they could have hit the transmitters. They could have made it so that Radio Television Serbia would have taken days to get up and running again, but they didn't. They hit a place where they knew that they would do maximum killing, that they would kill a maximum number of people to really spark horror in the population. Oh my God, they hit the television station.
So speaking of that popular word now, terrorism, to terrorize people oftentimes, besides the horrors of that happen directly to the people and their families. Well, Jeremy Scahill, so much to talk about. How about if you would, talking a little bit about your experience in Iraq? We only have like 5 minutes left. Mm.
Well, you know, I have a 2-year-old daughter right now, and I remember when my wife was pregnant. But we spent the whole war together in Yugoslavia, my wife and I, and you know, both of us were exposed to depleted uranium, particularly when we were traveling in Kosovo. You couldn't escape the reality of depleted uranium being around you. In fact, I remember Robert Fisk talking once about how he wasn't thinking, and he put a depleted uranium coated bullet in his pant pocket. And I remember him talking about how he was just very nervous that he had done that. And you know, he came in direct contact with this highly radioactive coated bullet. And you know, when my wife was pregnant and I knew that we had been exposed to that, I had these flashbacks back to when I was in the south of Iraq in Basra in 1998 in the weeks leading up to Operation Desert Fox, when the U.S. bombed Iraq for a little over a week in 1998, very heavily. They, of course, bomb Iraq an average of three times a week still. But when it was the sort of second to Gulf War, as they called it. And I remember visiting Basra, which is in the south of Iraq. It's not far from Kuwait. It was sort of the main area where the U.S. used these highly toxic munitions, these depleted uranium munitions. And I visited a number of children's hospitals down in Basra, where cancer rates, childhood leukemia rates are rising, you know, 33%. They've risen 33% since the end of the Gulf War in this area of Iraq in the south, in Basra. And I remember sitting with this woman who was 8 months pregnant, whose husband had been in the Iraqi military, and she herself lived in the war zone where all of these toxic munitions were being used by the United States. And it was the first time that she had been in a hospital in her entire pregnancy, and it was the first time she had had an ultrasound. And when we were there, the doctors discovered that the baby had no brain, and this woman was told that you're going to have to give birth to this child, and the child is going to be born dead. And the doctor said it's a direct result of her being exposed to depleted uranium. I saw children born with birth defects that don't exist in medical journals. Children born with no mouth. I remember meeting the 7-day-old child who now is dead, whose mouth consisted just of a hole that stretched from his nose to his throat. This is the other side. This is the face of American foreign policy. It is the ugly face of American foreign policy that Americans almost never have to confront. And what happened, what happened on September 11th, I think was painful for any American. I think it was painful for a lot of people around the world. And I mean, I was with people that had been bombed for 79 days by the United States. And the first thing they said when they heard was they asked, is my family okay? Do I have friends that were in the building? They were only concerned about me. No one was jubilant. No one was celebrating. People were just concerned. And as Americans, do we extend that same compassion for people when it's our bombs hitting all over the world, when it's American government bombs dropping on the people of Iraq or Yugoslavia, perhaps in Somalia or Sudan or Iraq once again? Will we have that same compassion? I'm afraid to say that I don't think we will. And, the good thing that could have come from this September 11th, if anything, from this horrific period that we're in could have come, it would have been we as Americans collectively looking at what we've done and looking at the cause behind it. And unfortunately, that's not happening. Yeah.
Well, Jeremy Scahill, it's just so moving and so important that people hear about this. And I know we could talk for many hours. I'm glad I could get you. You're just passing through the East Bay in California here real quick. And I would like to urge people to, if you're not able to hear Free Speech Radio news on the radio regularly, go to fsrn.org on the internet. Press your stations where you live to carry it. And also Democracy Now, one word, democracynow.org is another place where you can sometimes hear Jeremy Scahill and you can get a lot of information. So I'm sorry our time is up, but it is. Thank you so much, Jeremy Scahill, and I wish you the best in your future life. I look forward to hearing you.
Thank you very much, Sue. It was good to be with you.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.